This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for oral argument is State of South Dakota versus Ronald Blackcloud. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Blackcloud, Joanna Lawler will be arguing, and Lori Goad is appearing. On behalf of the appellee, State of South Dakota, Jennifer Jorgensen will be arguing. Each side will have a 15-minute initial argument, and then Ms. Lawler, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. So with that, Ms. Lawler, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Ronnie Blackcloud was denied a fair trial starting from the point of jury selection throughout the trial, during jury instructions, and through to sentencing. Both the prosecution and the judge played a role in making this process unjust, unfair, and unconstitutional. First, during jury selection, the prosecutor disclosed to the jury panel that Ronnie's co-defendant, Ross Johnson, was charged with the same crime as Ronnie, that he had pleaded guilty, that he had accepted responsibility, and that he would be testifying for the state against Ronnie. That was clearly improper and amounts to reversible error on its face. The prejudice was compounded when Ross didn't testify, when the court precluded the defense from questioning witnesses or calling a witness to discuss the plea agreement, and by refusing to instruct the jury to not consider Ross's guilty plea as evidence of Ronnie's guilt. Also during jury selection, the prosecutor misrepresented the law, indicating that the judge was the sole reason that a 14-year-old child was in adult court, which violated Ronnie's right to a fair and impartial jury trial. This amounted to prosecutorial misconduct, and the motion for mistrial should have been granted.
Counsel, with regard to that last point, it was brought to the court's attention, and then the jury was instructed as to the actual transfer proceeding. So we have to look at it in that lens. That's what actually happened. Why was that not sufficient to cure any issue with regard to what was said about the transfer process?
First, I think it would have been difficult to cure because the conversation as it started made the jury aware of a process that they were never meant to be aware of. All the jury heard essentially was, even with the follow-up instructions, that the case was bad enough in the judge's eyes that this child should be in adult court. It wasn't a given. It was a process. It was a decision made by the judge. And
do you think it's a legitimate area of voir dire for the state or the defense, for that matter, to talk about Mr. Blackcloud's youth and his age?
I think there may be a proper way to ask about that, to see what the jury's opinion is on that, but I think that it would have to steer clear of these pretrial decisions that were made.
I read it a couple times, all the back and forth and the discussions with the individual judges that occurred after the, what we'll call the clarification in this case, it seemed like they were, as a group, willing to accept that, as the judge later put it, we are where we are. But maybe I'm misreading it. Maybe I need to look at something different. What do you think?
I think in looking at those jury panel members' responses, it was clear that they were aware that there was a process. And yes, that we are where we are, but in between, they were made aware that the judge had a hand in this process. So unlike a typical jury trial where the jury comes in, there's the state, there's the defense. The state is bringing the charges. It's their burden to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. The judge is a neutral arbiter who doesn't have a say in this. That's not what this jury panel heard. They heard that this judge has already weighed in, that it wasn't a given that this child would be in adult court, that the judge made decisions based on facts and the law, which is another reason why the instruction didn't fully cure it. It's a mix of fact and law in the transfer process, that this case was bad enough, either because of who Ronnie was or because of the facts of the case, that he deserved to be in adult court. And at that point, I think it was impossible to cure it by then because the jury had heard it, and I think it was clear from their responses that they took that into account.
I'm sorry, forgive me, I keep interrupting. So you think that the jury would infer from the transfer process itself that the judge had predetermined some factual issue bearing upon Mr. Blackcloud's guilt, and that it wasn't just a process about where to try him, it was something more significant in terms of findings. If I've got your argument right, what in the record do you think really helps you with that argument?
It comes from the responses from that veneer, the members of the jury saying, well, if there was this process that went through, then I'll accept that the judge has decided that this is where we should be. And it's that judge's hand, I think, that makes it an impartial thing and makes it an error.
Was there something that told them, though, that because they are where they are, that creates some sort of indication of guilt or presumption of guilt or something that they can use in the quantum of evidence to assess guilt?
I think it absolutely does. If it had just been, as you sort of indicated earlier, that, sometimes kids can be tried as adults, here we are, that would be one thing. But to go through about how there was a process and how the judge heard evidence and the judge made these decisions, that therefore the judge has a hand in it, and he's no longer a neutral arbiter. And so I think for those reasons, the discussions that the state and then the judge had with that panel were not sufficient to cure the error. And the mistrial should have been granted.
If we go back to the first matter you addressed, and this was the co-defendants entering into a plea and that coming up at voir dire. So as I understand the record at that time, the state was of the belief that he would be testifying, and then that happened later where he didn't. So at the time of voir dire, why is that not a perfectly legitimate area of inquiry? Because it is the typical mode of cross-examination if that testimony would have come in.
Well, the Missouri Supreme Court has found that it is plain error on its face to get that specific about even bringing up a co-defendant who was convicted or who pleaded
to the related area, but more the specificity of what came in. That
yes, I think it's a very common area of voir dire to say, how do you feel about someone who took a plea deal testifying? But to make it that specific, he was charged with the same thing. He pleaded guilty. He accepted responsibility. No mention that it was to a lesser charge. That, at least according to the Missouri court, this court hasn't examined that, brings it to a level of clear and reversible error. Now, that error can be counteracted if there is a cross-examination, if he had been able to testify, if he had testified, and if we had been able to cross-examine him. But because that didn't happen, the error was never resolved.
Is the Missouri case, the Missouri line of cases, different, though? And their early 80s, that Jordan case is an early 80s case. It was before Olano. So the version of plain error that the Missouri court applied there isn't exactly the same as our more contemporary version of plain error, but still it had some features of it, it looks like. But they were citing some early 70s cases. And we now know, looking at it through the lens of Olano, that which we have to do today in this court and in this case, we'd have to have error and we'd have to have plain error. And so you could sort of maybe think about Jordan in the sense that there was a governing rule by virtue of these early 1970s cases that said, don't do that. And if you don't, if it comes in and you're the judge and you don't fix it on your own, you may have error and it may be plain. And we're assessing its impact upon substantial rights. But as you say, in your brief, we just don't have that rule. Is that a problem for plain error here?
Well, given that this is a matter of first impression for this court, I think that will be for this court to decide. We urge this court to adopt a similar line of reasoning to the Missouri courts, which did look at other jurisdictions and at the state and federal level to come up with this line of cases that has come through to today. And I think that the error then was compounded that the defense was not allowed to bring up any more information that would have helped clarify the error. Cross-examination would have helped. Being able to question law enforcement officers about the parameters of the plea agreement would have helped to clarify that Ross didn't just plead guilty as charged.
Well, so I thought that did come in, though. At least one of the questions was answered by the law enforcement officer that he pled to a lesser charge.
He believes,
that did get in the record.
Yes, it was a lesser charge. It wasn't clarified what it was. And it still didn't undo the prejudice of Ronnie being able to put forth a full defense. When the argument is self-defense or defense of others, and we find out that the co-defendant, the person he was protecting, as he argued, pleaded guilty, that gives the inference that Ross didn't think that he needed protection, that there was no need for self-defense.
I'm having trouble understanding what else you would have wanted to get in other than that you think would have helped your client's defense.
I'm not sure that being able to question the officer, being able to question the attorney, or even the jury instruction would have been enough to cure the error, honestly, without that cross-examination. I think it might have helped. I think getting in what he actually pleaded to, what the terms of the plea agreement were, the proffer that he gave, just some more information to the jury, because all they were left with is that he accepted responsibility and he was willing to testify for the state.
But, you know, and I don't know what the proffer would have been, but presumably it would have been not favorable to your client. So how would getting in the proffer details have assisted in your defense? That's what I'm having trouble understanding.
And that does go back to, I think it really, cross-examination would have been the best way to cure the error.
If he would have testified himself.
If he had testified.
And of course, that's not in the control of the court or
that didn't. State. Yeah, he didn't follow through with the terms of his plea deal. And I understand that the state didn't anticipate that. But we always know that we have to be careful with how we present evidence that we think is going to come in. And so it was improper to bring it up at that level during voir dire and to leave the jury with the impression that the co-defendant didn't think that self-defense was an issue.
Did the state disclose to you, pursuant to Brady, the terms of the plea agreement and what it was and all of that? Did they disclose the proffer? Did you have the proffer? Did you know what Ross Johnson said?
Yes, I believe we did.
Okay, but we don't have that.
It's not part of the record. We weren't able to get that in trial.
I understand your argument, and I really understand what you're saying on this jury instruction. But maybe similar to what Justice DeVaney was saying, I'm trying to put it together here in terms of assessing prejudice to your client. The state had the obligation to prove there was no justification beyond a reasonable doubt. They promised a witness who presumably was going to help them with that. That never came to pass. They overextended on their opening statement and in voir dire and overpromised and underdelivered in terms of this testimony. Ultimately, it's their obligation. Viewed through that perspective, how does that impact your prejudice argument?
It's prejudice because Ronnie was unable to present a complete defense that would give the full scope of what happened that night. Ross was the only other witness who was present who wasn't heard from. And so we were left with just the state's summary of what Ross might have testified to without being able to cross-examine
him. We do know from other elements of the record, not necessarily the jury trial, that he pled apparently to aggravated assault and maybe an accessory charge as well. So aggravated assault or any kind of assault, like a homicide offense, could have a justification defense. You could be defending yourself or somebody else, and that could be a defense for an aggravated assault crime too. So if he pled guilty and the guilty plea was accepted and he got sentenced, presumably there's no justification defense with that plea. So again, trying to assess prejudice here.
I'm not sure that somebody pleading guilty to a lesser offense makes it so that no other potential defenses were available. People plead guilty, especially pursuant to plea agreements, all the time, and they have to do their own risk-reward analysis. But the point is, we were not able to cross-examine Ross about what happened to identify the issues that may have occurred.
Ms. Lawler, before your time gets away, I want to ask you about two things. One is, on your reply brief, it seems like you've kind of conceded the transfer issue. Am I reading that right?
We admit that we didn't properly preserve that for appeal.
Okay. My second question is sentencing. You raise both abuse of discretion, constitutional issue. Tell me, rule, case, whatever, that's going to convince us that we've got either a constitutional issue or an abuse of discretion here.
And I think both of those rely on Miller. The Miller factors that the court analyzed but then kind of seemed to go against, and the disparities that exist both between Ronnie and Ross's sentences, but also other children in the state of South Dakota that have been sentenced for second-degree murder. The racial disparities, the differences between the facts of those cases and Ronnie's, his age, his involvement with it. There are people who have much lower sentences than his, and most of those people pled to a lesser offense they were originally charged with, first-degree murder.
Okay. I just want to make sure nobody else has any other follow-ups on that. Good, thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Jorgensen, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel, this is a murder case. On August 17, 2018, defendant Ronald Blackcloud heard his friend Ross Johnson say, "Ronnie, shoot that mother effer." So defendant did. Defendant raised a 9mm semi-automatic pistol at Nathan Graham, who is approximately 69 feet away, and fired two shots. One of the shots hit Graham in the back of the head. Defendant fled the scene and disposed of the gun. Defendant raises multiple issues on appeal. Defendant is not entitled to any relief, so the state respectfully asks this court to affirm the circuit court's decisions.
Ms. Jorgensen, when the prosecutor said in response to a direct question from a member of the veneer that the state did not have anything to do with this decision to bring the Mr. Blackcloud into adult court, and that was a decision of the courts. Is that improper?
Your Honor, I recall that the state asked, was it the state's decision to transfer the defendant to adult court? And
The prosecutor said, whose decision was it? Anyone know? And there was some guesses and some questions, and someone wanted to know whether it was the state's. No, is the answer. It's the court's.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let me put it to you this way. Is that completely accurate?
No, Your Honor, that is not completely accurate. The defendant objected, and the circuit court said that there was clarification that could be given, that the state filed the petition, that the state opened the door to that being brought into the veneer, that the veneer could know that.
Well, how is the clarification given by the prosecutor sufficient?
The clarification by the prosecutor was sufficient because there was no objection by the defendant, or the defendant did not contest that in any way, that they thought that was improper. So the court did not abuse its discretion and denying that motion to dismiss because no prosecutorial misconduct occurred regarding that juvenile transfer issue. Prosecutorial misconduct implies a dishonest act or attempt to persuade the jury by use of deception. The state's comments did not involve an attempt to persuade the jury by use of deception. The state's comments, taken in their totality, accurately summarize the transfer proceedings.
Well, the comments, the clarification, right? I think the error that the defense is signing and pointing to is what led up to that. Now, whether the effort to cure it was successful or not, you know, remains to be seen. It's an issue on appeal, obviously. And so, but you and I just had this discussion, and you said, yeah, that wasn't right. That, well, you said that's, you agreed that wasn't accurate. So, and it looks like to me it also wasn't a mistake. It almost, the court or the transcript seems to be fairly clear that the prosecutor said, we don't want to look like the bad guys, or we're trying to avoid that, or words to that effect. Didn't want the state to look like the bad guys in this transfer proceeding. So it doesn't look like it was a mistake. So if the test for prosecutorial misconduct is one, something that is improper or is an effort to mislead or deceive or do whatever, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but that wasn't accurate. Are we there on prong one, or are we there on, or we move on to prejudice, in your view, to resolve this issue? Do we linger on prong one?
I don't believe that it was prosecutorial misconduct. The comments were vague, but I don't believe that it was, they were stated in a way to persuade the jury on this matter for that issue. But even if we linger, or if we move past prong one, on appeal, the defendant does isolate specific veneers persons that he alleged formed an opinion about the transfer process. The defendant had the opportunity to challenge those jurors for cause, and he chose not to do so. He fails to show that the jurors that were passed for cause and ultimately seated to hear the case were not impartial. Further, in addition to the clarifying statements made by the state and by the court, the jury was given multiple other instructions regarding the juror's role at trial. For example, the jury was instructed what was evidence, that statements of counsel are not evidence, and that the jury must determine the facts from the evidence received at trial and not any other source. We presume that the juries follow these instructions and have no reason to believe that they did not do so in this case. And regardless, the evidence in this case was overwhelming. Testimony from witnesses and defendant himself support his conviction. Defendant does not dispute that he shot Graham. Testimony from Shayla and defendant show that the confrontation between Ross and Graham had ended and that Graham was walking away. Evidence of Graham's injuries showed that he was shot in the back of the head. A reconstruction of the scene showed that the defendant was standing approximately 69 feet away when he raised that 9mm gun and shot Graham.
In your brief, you made the argument, we've kind of glossed over it here this morning, and maybe we don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but we're addressing this on the merits. In your brief, you suggest that the defense has waived this issue, which I'm reading to mean forfeited the issue, a la Olano. But do you still believe that?
Yes, Your Honor, I do still stand by that. When the defendant presented his motion for mistrial before the circuit court, he made the motion based on juror misconceptions about the transfer proceedings.
So the first objection was by defense counsel was to the initial the state has no role, the courts made the decision to transfer. The objection was, I think it's misleading to the jury to leave them with the misapprehension that the state got stuck with this case in adult court when they actively sought it. That seems to be pretty clearly an objection that the state has just done something improper. Would you agree that preserves that initial claim?
For the initial statement, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then, so what about the follow-up mistrial? Is there was a mistrial motion, and there were reasons cited, and I guess we're going to figure out whether, you know, we'll review it, but what's missing in terms of preserving the error for that?
So when defendant filed his motion for mistrial, he said that our efforts to cure this issue were not sufficient. Defendant requested this clarifying statement that was given. If there was issues because of that clarifying statement, the defendant requested that. And that was the reasons sought for the motion for mistrial, was because of the misperceptions that the juror had on factual issues because of the clarifying statements. Additionally, Defendant is not entitled to a limitless cross-examination of Shayla. An individual is only guaranteed an opportunity for effective cross-examination, not cross-examination that's effective in whatever way and to whatever extent the defendant might wish. Here, defendant was attempting to establish Shayla's motive to lie, not based on her own parole status. Defendant was attempting to establish Shayla's motive to lie based on Graham's parole status and what she knew about that parole status. The proffer established that Shayla believed Graham was on parole. The proffer did not establish what Shayla thought were parole violations. Additionally, Shayla would only conceivably have a motive to lie to protect her husband if she thought that Graham might live and need protection, but there was no indication in the record that she thought he might live.
So the initial statement that it seemed like a lot of this back and forth concerned, from my read of the record, it appeared that never came into evidence anyway, or did it?
The state's unclear what statement the defendant wanted into evidence. There was some statements that Shayla made to law enforcement when they responded to the scene that there was an argument between Graham and Ross. The state's unsure if that's the statement that defendant wanted in. There was also an indication
My question is, did any of that come in, what she initially stated at the scene?
Yes, Your Honor. In one of the videos, Shayla can be heard saying in the background that there was an argument between Ross and Graham, so that did come in.
Okay, but that's not really the issue. I assume what they were getting more at is whether or not there was physical contact, whether she had made any statement refuting that.
I am not aware of any statements in the record where Shayla said there was, besides at trial.
Her testimony.
Yeah, her testimony. Besides her testimony, I'm not aware of any statements in the record where Shayla says, yes, there was a fist fight between Ross and Graham, or no, there was not a fist fight between Ross and Graham. The only statement I'm aware of is her saying that there was an argument.
This issue took on a new dimension during the trial. It was litigated initially, it seems, as part of the state's motion in limine to keep out some of this information, including criminal history and some other things, decided principally on the basis of relevancy, as near as I can tell, or the relevancy rules. But by its own admission, the defense had a slightly different thought about it during the trial and brought it up again, and the court heard it. So it wasn't so much consistency or inconsistency, as I read the record, it was more a question of a motive to lie from the get-go. So, and I read the court's ruling during the trial, and the court makes the point that you just make about this, you know, motivation to lie and consistency and all of that, and then kind of ends it and just says, well, and otherwise, I think he says it wouldn't be proper, it'd be improper, or something like that. But I don't know that the court really ever addressed that different argument that they made during the trial, which was, hey, she had a motive to lie from the get-go because she didn't want this to happen, and now she's going to come in. She surely doesn't want to change her testimony. It's not about inconsistency with a prior statement. It's about continuing a motivation to make it look good and to be consistent, whether Nathan is passed away or not. Did the court ever really address that? And do you think the state needs to address that?
The court did make a relevancy ruling. The court did not specifically make a ruling on whether she had a continued motive to lie. Defendant has the obligation to have issues ruled on by the circuit court to preserve those issues for appeal. If there's an incomplete record, that is on the defendant to make sure there is a complete record.
Well, I mean, they made the objection. They made the argument. I mean, I just didn't see that anyone addressed that argument, which I think is different than the way it was postured before the trial. Thank you.
Thank you. So the court properly exercised its discretion when it imposed that reasonable limitation, and that reasonable limitation did not result in prejudice. The court did not limit defendant from cross-examining Shayla about her alleged motive to lie because she was married to Graham or whether there was any factual matters, factual disputes. Defendant could have still cross-examined Shayla on those issues, like whether Graham engaged in any illegal conduct on the night in question, whether Graham punched Ross, or whether she had a gun. Indeed, defendant did cross-examine Shayla about the altercation and then Graham being a trained boxer.
Can I ask you a question, and I'm going to take you into an issue you haven't addressed, but is the issue concerning the plea agreement for Ross Johnson? He didn't plead guilty to murder. This prosecutor seemed to say that he had. Again, same questions I asked earlier in the argument. Is that accurate? And do you read the record as I do that that's what she said?
I believe the prosecutor stated that Ross Johnson had been charged with the same crime. And then moving forward in the voir dire, they talk about that the jury would want to know what he pled guilty to know what kind of deal he got, to judge his credibility on that issue.
Is that okay? Is that proper?
Yes, Your Honor. I do not see anything improper with that.
It's not accurate. He didn't plead guilty to murder.
I believe the state said that he had been charged with the same crime as defendant. It wouldn't have been accurate if the state did say that he pled guilty to murder. That would not be proper.
Okay, sorry. I'm going to grab it here. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. So under Issue 3, the court did not plainly err during the state's voir dire regarding its comments of Ross Johnson. There was no error that occurred. The state's comments were within the scope of voir dire because the question sought to uncover bias and determine if the voir dire could be impartial regarding that evidence and judge the credibility of Ross Johnson. Further, prospective jurors can have knowledge. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jurgens. Ms. Law, you may proceed with rebuttal argument.
Thank you. As to the issue of voir dire and the motion for mistrial, the state just now argued that the defense is the one that requested the clarification that came out at first, that the state offered and then that the judge clarified. And I just wanted to correct that. It was the judge who decided that either he or the prosecutor would be issuing a clarifying statement. The defense was not consulted or indeed given an option to clarify that ourselves. And that issue was preserved when we moved for mistrial. It would have been impossible to challenge it or follow up with every single veneer person who was there at the time. There were a lot of potential jurors there. And so the motion for mistrial preserved the issue.
It almost seems like there's two issues, both of which were preserved, it seems like. One was the issue concerning the initial statement, suggesting that you know, this was only the court's problems. There was an objection to that. That got addressed. Then there was the mistrial. So it seems like there's two things going on here. And it seems like there was objections at both turns.
I agree. Thank you, Your Honor. As to Shayla's testimony, Shayla did testify that there were no punches thrown. That was something that the state even cited in its closing argument, that Shayla had indicated, and she was the most reliable witness, that there was no altercation and therefore no need for self-defense. And that it was prejudicial then that we didn't get to ask questions about Shayla's potential motive to lie, that is that Nathan Graham was on probation at the time. He had been violated and extradited out of state back to Pennsylvania for parole violations in the past. So things like getting into a fight with kids or having a gun in the house could very well have been in violation of his probation.
So this
parole.
Is another one that I'm trying to figure out how it would have played out, because as I read the record, it appeared that the state had been trying to get in her initial, because you're no longer talking about her trial testimony because he's now deceased, so there's no concern about his parole status then. So it had to have been at the time she made the initial statements is what you were arguing. But those didn't come into the record, I don't believe, and at least from the colloquy with the court, it sounded like the state was trying to get in some of those statements and the defense objected to them coming in. But now you were here, you're arguing, in order to make that motive, you would have to rely on what she initially said. So how, I'm trying to figure out how that would have played out, and it didn't make sense given what happened leading up to that witness.
Sure, and I do agree with the state that I think some of that initial interview with the police on the night of the shooting involved the police questioning Shayla about what happened and her indicating that there had been no physical altercation.
And didn't the defense object to getting that in?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and to be truthful, I don't remember exactly whether we objected to that, but I think the jury did hear at least parts of her interview with the police the night of the offense when it wasn't clear whether Nathan Graham was going to live or die.
So it just seemed like, so then when you're crossing her, then you, if I understand you right, then you wanted to put in through cross-examination that she made consistent statements and said that there was no punch or hit by her husband.
And
you think that would be helpful to the defense to say that she's being consistent, but yet, so then there's a motive.
We wanted to be able to question her on her motive to lie to the police initially about what happened that night leading up to the shooting. And the argument is that because she did know about Nathan Graham's parole status, she had an incentive to minimize Nathan Graham's involvement with the altercation. And we weren't able to get at that. We weren't able to get at any kind of motive to lie. And so when the state then in closing says she's the only one who doesn't have any motive here, we weren't able to push back on that based on the court's ruling about us being able to question her about Nathan Graham's parole status.
And that was a statement made in the state's closing?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so, that no punches were thrown and that she had no motive to lie. And I do think that that gets to the heart of Ronnie's defense and his ability to create a complete defense. And the state then questioned Shayla about Nathan Graham's character and what a good guy he was. We also argued that that opened the door for us to be able to question her again, at least about that parole status, and that was also denied.
Is that, I'm sorry, I know you're only a couple seconds, but is that, I wasn't sure if that was part of the appeal or not, the door opening. I know it's referenced, but I went back to try to see if that was part of it. It seemed like maybe it wasn't.
May I answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
We intended it to be part of the appeal, that the door was opened.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted. We'll